Happiness is an intricate state of mind, it's a byproduct of a life well lived. It is wrong to treat happiness as a feeling that can be bought, that it would eventually come calling once we achieve our ever-evolving goals. From what we have learned over time, happiness, instead, is a fleeting state of mind that many have chased and very few had reached. In essence, this book fixates on the elusive euphoria that happiness is, and it tries to present you a template that could help you mold a happy existence. Firstly, though, you should never rate happiness by relying only on external factors like money, power, or a great body. These goals, as we have come to tag them, would never quench our thirst for fulfillment. Our capacity to achieve one goal would naturally give birth to more goals. In other words, living is like partaking in a never-ending race. Happiness is not a goal, it's a byproduct of a life well lived, Tilda Eleanor Roosevelt. Yet, the universe is indifferent to our goals. The things we can control are so minute compared to the things beyond our grasp. Contrary to the order that we claim should define happiness, chaos permeates the universe. You have no control over famine, depressions, drought, or diseases. Furthermore, our society identifies, curtails, and capitalizes on our genetics, which prioritizes survival above every other thing. Our genetic codes program us to take pleasure in food and sex, just so we would replenish depleted nutrients and reproduce. As such, society has taught us to conform to rules that push us to fight some of our instincts. It relies on a reward and punishment system that ignites fear and the expectation that our actions today will determine our future. And so, you learn to fall in line, so you could reap the rewards that your parents, your boss, and the society have promised you. Nonetheless, happiness thrives in people that value and understand the power of consciousness. Realizing this truth will help you control fear and anxiety. It will fortify you with the awareness of the delirious nature of social systems, and how to accept or take the reward they avail. Conscious and attention work hand in hand to shape who you are. Cultures have introduced different ways of mastering our consciousness. Until recently, people had valued the capacity to take on a reflective approach to life rather than an instinctive one. Consciousness is the differentiating factor between reflection and instinct. While instinct is our natural response to stimuli or external factors, reflection, on the other hand, helps us put things into perspective. It is our consciousness that processes all the information received via our sensory system, and it aligns them with past events, before making a judgment. In other words, consciousness filters all the information generated within and outside our body. Consequently, it allows us to prioritize the information that should command our attention. Also, it is now possible to manipulate perception by altering the prevailing contents of our consciousness. As such, you could choose to remain happy regardless of external hardship. However, there is no way to ascertain the true limits of our consciousness-altering capacity. Lack of direction, not lack of time, is the problem. We all have 24-hour days. Tilda Zig Ziglar. The author revealed that the average person processes 126 bits of information in a second. Besides, once we master an activity, our thought process no longer delegates core mental resources to it. For instance, a person that is used to a particular route would require less of its conscious self when plying this route. This mastery is because his or her consciousness has developed an automated response to the twists and turns that would normally require the complete concentration of someone new to the same route. Bearing this in mind, it becomes clear that attention or concentration determines the things that we subject our consciousness to. There are a lot of things fighting for your attention on a daily, and it is impossible for you to fit all of them into your conscious mind. Therefore, you choose the things you fixate and reminisce on while other events or information barely stays rooted in your thoughts. In essence, our thought process involves the information we have decided to pay attention to and the continuous analysis which our consciousness subjects them to. If this process obeys a well-balanced system, wherein no one information dislodges the goals that had become the bedrock of our existence, we can say that we have found order in consciousness, which the author called flow. When there is a disorder in your consciousness, resulting from information that threatens the viability of your goal, you tend to lose focus. Losing focus could generate hate, fear, jealousy, anxiety, and so on. All in all, the true standard for your consciousness is your capacity to attain a level of complexity that establishes flow. Flow rightly combines autonomous individuality and awareness of the ideas and goals of other entities. It is only when you find this balance that you can find happiness in the most unlikely of places. The flow experience transcends pleasure, it involves activities that require skill and conscious complexity. Flow, as we have described in the previous chapter, comes from the mental balance that concentrates us into activities. The activities and information in this context are those that would work intricately in making our goals come to fruition. From the extensive study, which this book narrates, the author concludes that flow experience had common traits, regardless of the location, culture, age, and sex of the person describing his or her personal optimal experience. For one, flow experience transcends pleasure as it involves activities that require skill and conscious complexity. Pleasure, which many believe is symbolic to happiness, does not obey this simple condition. On the other hand, enjoyment fits into this context perfectly. To enjoy an activity, you must have developed the skill, which allows you to minimize errors. Also, such activities encapsulate a large portion of our consciousness and it becomes easier to let go of the future or the past. People rarely succeed unless they have fun in what they are doing. Tilda Dale Carnegie. Enjoyment comes from an ability to receive feedback from each moment spent subjecting yourself into a task. Likewise, the fickleness of time rarely comes to mind when we are engrossed in flow experience. When you participate in truly rewarding and exhilarating activities, hours could shrink to minutes or minutes could stretch into hours. However, since games, play, and art are the most common examples of flow activities known to man, it is easier to fall into the abyss of competition. Competition is not the enemy of optimal experience, though. It even contributes to it, only if the motivation for competing is a burning passion to acquire more skills. In contrast, competing so you could beat your opponent or impress the audience is the bane of the flow experience. As such, activities that should propel us to epiphany slowly becomes the very source of our unhappiness. Therefore, it is not surprising that some would find contentment and happiness in detention camps while other people are unable to find happiness in comfort. The same is true for the growing rate of depression today, which contradicts today's lifestyle that has access to gadgets and technologies that somewhat make living easier. Paramount to the disturbing narrative of today's unhappy generation is the reclassification of medical and habitual factors that could ground an individual's capacity to experience flow. For example, medical conditions that limit our control over the things that our consciousness processes can stifle happiness. Besides, self-consciousness and self-centeredness are known habitual factors that contribute to an attention disorder. While some medical conditions relating to this disorder can be traced to neurological deficiencies, there is also a correlation between a person's upbringing and his or her flow tendencies. Your body and mind are core to flow experience. Your body is the custodian of a hoard of sensory capabilities that you can channel into activities that promise optimal experience. Here, the author reveals how you can master different parts of your body to access a pleasurable conscious state. Action in itself, especially the ones meant to stretch the limits of our bodies, is an access point to a flow experience. You could run faster, throw farther, jump higher, and subject your consciousness to achieving feats that you had previously struggled to accomplish. Similarly, it is possible to enjoy less tedious activities like walking. Regardless of the form of exercise, you might choose, the vital thing is to introduce goal-oriented motivation by utilizing milestones. Happiness is a state of activity, Tilda Aristotle. Also, enjoyment could come from dancing, as it is an essential part of many cultural models, which looks to immerse its people into a conscious state that resonates pleasure. Sex, however, stands on a pedestal that rival basic survival instincts. Yet, many find elusive the pleasure which sex connotes. To some, monogamy is the enemy of a good sex life, while the abuse of sex has robbed others of its upsides. To sidestep this, some cultures have introduced eroticism, which is a candid attempt to cultivate physical skills that could optimize the act of sex itself. More importantly, it is imperative that relationships and bonds are built on the sense of adventure where two people make it a lifetime task to know more about each other. Like sex, food should also command the same thoughtfulness. You could make every bite a conscious ritual. Those who have gone to great lengths to revel in the art of food, that have taught their palates to enjoy the art of tasting, have turned eating to a source of optimal experiences. The same is true for those who have learned to value every tune emanating from a melody. Just as the body holds countless loops into the realm of enjoyment, the mind can also facilitate flow in diverse ways. the most common way known to man is the pleasure derived from seeing. You could choose to see art in just about anything. You could concentrate all your attention to written words and artworks, and find the same level of flow that you could draw from physically imposing activities. Furthermore, the art of thinking is one of the mental rituals that could drive an optimal experience. So also, the entrenchment in science, history, psychology, as well as the revel in mentally tasking puzzles and intricacies of spoken words, can facilitate an optimal experience. Different things and conditions motivate people differently. Flow, as we have established in previous chapters, is the essence of happiness. And there is no part of our lives that hold greater leverage on flow than work. Work is the defining activity that you have come to serve as a channel to enforce your core goals. As such, success at work should normally translate into a sustainable flow state. However, time and again, this has not been the case. On the contrary, success in our jobs doesn't necessarily mean that what we do is fulfilling. The author arrived at this conclusion when he realized that the working conditions or tedious nature of work do not correlate to how much people enjoy doing them. Different things and conditions motivate people differently. While some have found it extremely difficult to cope under pressure, others relish the mental rigor deadlines and challenges avail them. Nothing is really work unless you would rather be doing something else, Tilda J.M. Barry. More importantly, it is essential that we categorize the true essence of a job, and how much ecstasy it propels. Here, the author revealed that jobs, like hunting, fishing, or other works that have similar patterns to games, have the tendency to spur participants to revel in each second invested into them. Whereas jobs that require repetitive tasks are boring. Regardless of the nature of their jobs, the average American reported that he or she experienced more flow while working than when he or she had free time. One could argue that the social commentary that work defines the usefulness of every human being is at play here. Leisure, on the other hand, is most of the time spent on less enjoyable activities or amidst unproductive company. Note here that unproductivity brought about by companioning with the wrong set of people is likely a function of disdain for solitude. While solitude has inspired some of the revolutionary thoughts the world has seen, many still find it difficult to bask in being alone. Rather, we grapple with any relationship we might find, irrespective of its consequence on our flow. An individual that can thrive in solitude has successfully detached his or her consciousness order from extrinsic factors. Although this skill is essential to maintaining our unique self, yet, it goes against the very fabric of our nature. Human beings thrive in a communal model where relationships and communication distract us from the negativity that could cloud our consciousness when we are alone. As such, you must strike a balance between honing solitude and reveling in the benefits of companionship. Interestingly enough, relationships, marriages, families, and friendships are critical contributors to entropic disorder as well as optimal experience. Our capacity to channel all these fragments of human relations as fuel for our consciousness, while concentrating efforts to keep them as healthy as possible, is the only way to sustain flow. You can find flow in chaos. As mentioned earlier, the symbolism of happiness, like money, comfort, good health, and power, do not necessarily translate to flow. Throughout man's existence, we have admired individuals who had found peace in chaos, who had found meaning to disorder, who had stuck to their goal, regardless of the determining force at play. These people command a sense of awareness of their surroundings, and they have built transformative mechanisms that had helped them cope with reality. Conversely, stress or helplessness would rid an average individual of his or her control over consciousness, especially when favorable mechanisms are not in place. This notion defines our varied response to situations that do not fit into our predefined goals. While this is a given, it is even more critical for people that have structured their whole existence to obey genetic and social instructions. On the one hand, genetically induced goals are food, comfort, sex, and dominance. On the other hand, socially imposed goals include education, a good job, a happy family, and so on. Those that are rigidly programmed to live by these goals start to panic, once factors that are beyond their control threaten these two sets of goals, irrespective of how irrelevant the perceived chaos is. In contrast, the people that find flow in chaos had learned to set individualistic goals while weighing the challenges they may encounter in the long run. They immerse all of their consciousness into activities that would bring their goal to fruition, and they use the feedback received along the way to adjust the intensity of their progress. Needless to say, the thirst to base all our decisions to fulfill a particular purpose is born out of our increasingly complex consciousness. We want to find meaning to our existence, and live by a purpose that would drive us for the entirety of our life. Your inability to find an inexhaustible goal would subject your consciousness to chaos. This assertion makes sense considering religion's roles in the establishment of eternity as a viable purpose for humanity, and culture's inclination to treat immortality as the template by which all goals should stem from. Although these two templates have charged older generations to concentrate their minds on particular social instructions, the present world has steered away from these themes. The effect is the proliferation of individuality and the freedom to model goals based on personal insights. Conversely, freedom has also reduced our propensity to concentrate on a particular goal for a long stretch of time. There are too many possibilities and opportunities, and little to no restrictions. Conclusion. Happiness is not something that happens. It is not the result of good fortune or random chance. It is not something that money can buy or power command. It does not depend on outside events, but, rather, on how we interpret them. Happiness, in fact, is a condition that must be prepared for, cultivated, and defended privately by each person. People who learn to control inner experience will be able to determine the quality of their lives, which is as close as any of us can come to being happy. We cannot reach happiness by consciously searching for it. Ask yourself whether you are happy, and you cease to be so. It is by being fully involved with every detail of our lives, whether good or bad, that we find happiness, not by trying to look for it directly. Happiness cannot be pursued, it must ensue, as the unintended side effect of one's personal dedication to a course greater than oneself. Try this, find a goal that you find both challenging and fun. Build the skill sets required to excel in it, and your consciousness will automatically model your thought processes to facilitate an optimal experience.